I'm Melinda the Enforcer. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and this is the hashtag STR podcast for Stand to Reason.
Howdy.
Hi there. I don't think I actually quite finished that word, ask, STR ask podcast. Howdy.
I was waiting for that K. There you go.
The missing K.
Now we've had it twice.
Okay. You send us your questions on Twitter using hashtag STR ask, and I find them that way. And then we put Greg on a timer, and he's got 4 minutes to answer them. Are you ready?
Ready. Rock and roll. Right.
By the way, in between shows, you mentioned that my teen heartthrob passed away, David Cassidy.
Yeah, I thought about you when I heard about that.
Well, it's not like he's still my heartthrob.
I know.
My friend who texted me last Tuesday evening, you know, that he had passed away, my response to her was, you know, just what a waste at his age. And I heard his daughter has since said that his last words were, you know, so much wasted time.
Oh.
Yeah. That's really sad to get to the end of your life and
you
think
know what?
Too much wasted time.
Just this reminds me of something very quickly here. And that is many people have said regarding the end of life, who would say when they're on their deathbed, I should have spent more time at the office? And my response to that is, well, it depends what they did for a living.
Right.
If they did foolishness, nonsense, inconsequential things for a living, probably shouldn't have spent more time at the office. However, if their lives were spent in doing something deeply meaningful, well, maybe they should have spent more time at the office.
But you can still spend too much time at the office even when your work is
no,
a good
understand.
Thing.
Right. That's certainly possible.
I don't think he was referring to spending too much time at the office or his work. I think it was the talent, the life squandered because he did drugs for a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. He was an alcoholic. He returned to alcohol in the last several years. Mm. And I think, you know, he squandered away his family, too.
You know, it just goes to show what, you know, this lifestyle largely is a lie. I mean, there's so many people in that lifestyle, rich and famous and miserable, absolutely miserable.
Yep. Anyways, so.
People who are deeply satisfied don't generally turn to alcohol and drugs.
Right. Next, so let's get going. First question comes from Computers for Congo. That's something interesting to look up.
Yeah.
Australia just passed euthanasia laws. How can I respond to those who say, let them die with dignity in the manner they choose?
Okay, what I'm doing right now is I'm thinking of a question that I could ask, because the principle here is the assumption is that if a person takes their own life, this is dignified, and if they die a natural death, even though somewhat painful, it's not dignified. And so that's what I'd want to challenge. What is undignified about dying a natural death? Well, there may be a lot of pain. Well, this can be controlled to a great degree, but what is even so, why is that undignified? What this betrays is the idea that the most wonderful life is a life with the least amount of discomfort, pain, or inconvenience. Mm-hmm. Yet, as we just mentioned, those people who have the ability to avoid a pain and inconvenience because they have a lot of money, it turns out those lives are often miserable lives. And the people who are the most deeply satisfied are the ones that have endured pain and inconvenience for the sake of others. And so I don't buy the equation that dying without any discomfort or without any pain is the best way to go out, is the most dignified way.
But dying with dignity doesn't have to do with the physical nature of how you die.
That's
it has
right.
to do with how you handle the
yeah.
situation.
So maybe there's the question. The question is, what makes you think that dignity has to do with the physical way that you die? I mean, there's a question. Let them do some talking. There's all kinds of assumptions that are made in this situation. What good does that? How is it dignified for a person to commit suicide? I mean, this was never considered dignified before. Committing suicide was never considered a dignified way to go. But we have dignified it, the taking of one's own life. Why is that a dignified way to go? What is dignity anyway? Generally, dignity, you know, when you think about it, just back off of the topic for a moment and think about dignity. Dignity is expressed by people who hold their heads high.
It's your attitude.
In very difficult circumstances. That's dignity. Dignity is not running from the pain and the hardship. Mm-hmm. It is facing the pain and the hardship.
I was just thinking about that before you said it. And just in other, let's think about it in other situations, you know, for instance, poverty. There's plenty of people that we can see that even though they're living in difficult situations, poverty that doesn't allow them to have nice things around, or, you know, it's not their circumstances that give them dignity. Mm-hmm. It's how they live in that circumstance that is the dignity.
And there's also an assumption, and we were talking about this kind of in our staff meeting earlier, just in general about the culture. The assumption is if a person does it his way, that's dignified.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just let them, how does the question go, do it themselves or die on their own?
Let them die with dignity in the manner they choose.
In the manner they choose.
Right.
Why is dignity tied to the manner they choose? Why is that? And notice the presumption there that
captains of our,
that's it. The individual's
existence.
Ability to choose for themselves is the greatest good.
Right.
But not the individual's willingness to choose for the good of the community or society or for the greater good, however it's construed. That's a huge shift in the last 50 to 100 years in the way people look at things. It's all about me making my choice, and that is the essence of dignity, me getting to choose what I want to do.
Next question comes from Redox React 93. Do you believe that the law has passed away, the law, the Mosaic law? Jesus said, I have not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it.
Well, I guess it depends on what somebody means by the law has passed away. And what it means for Jesus to fulfill it. I think there, that's Matthew chapter 5, that's the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And I think what Jesus is doing is he's, and this is where the flow of thought is really important, he is talking about a standard that governs the Jews, okay? And he's saying, look it, how do you get out from underneath this difficult standard? Well, you can't just get rid of it. It's not going to go away. Secondly, even if you fulfill the letter of it, you haven't always fulfilled the spirit of it. In other words, you might not murder anybody, but if you call your brother fool or raka or whatever, you know, now that's still violating the spirit. You may have not committed adultery, but if you look at a woman with lust in your eyes, you've committed adultery in your heart. So there's a spirit behind this. It goes beyond just our behaviors, but our attitudes. And I think what's going on there is Jesus is aggravating the circumstance of the law. That is, he's using the law to show people that they are not capable of fulfilling it. And even though there are two moral things that he is describing there that are inappropriate, lusting after a woman with lust in your heart, his point is the demands of the law. And this is why just a little bit later he says, you are to be perfect as my heavenly Father is perfect, and that's the demand. So I think what Jesus is saying here is that you don't fulfill the demands of the law by getting rid of the law, either the Mosaic law that the Jews are under or general moral obligations that all human beings are under. One needs to be rescued from our culpability, and this is where the other element comes in. Jesus didn't come to abolish the law, but he came to fulfill it. In other words, he kept the law, and there's different ways that you could understand his sense of fulfilling, and he probably meant a couple of things, but one of them is he kept the law. He did what we didn't do so he could stand in our place and take the punishment for our failure to do what he did. So that's where the marvelous exchange comes in. He gets our badness, we get his goodness. He keeps the law, he fulfills it personally, and then he also fulfills it in a certain sense typologically by being the Paschal Lamb, the one who the sins are placed upon who identifies with the sins of the rest of us so that we could, by proxy, be forgiven through him. And so there are different elements or different aspects in the way the law is fulfilled through him. But you can see it as you look at the broader sense. The law condemns us. Jesus rescues us. He rescues us. That's a fulfillment of the law. And he rescues us by himself fulfilling the law by living under its obligations and never failing.
Hey, last question I'm going to give you 2 minutes on, because we're actually getting kind of close to the start of the regular broadcast that we have to,
has a
definite start time.
Got to go
and
to
that,
work.
You know, that's just a reminder, too, that Greg is still here on Tuesdays, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. You can call and talk to him, have a longer conversation. He gets more than 4 minutes to answer. Last question here comes from ISO Algorithm. Might the story of Jesus had been mythological originally and embellished? Lord, liar, lunatic, and legend.
Yeah.
Or legend.
Well, when a person says might, I guess that that could be construed as a theoretical possibility. There's nothing wrong with raising the question, but you might raise the same question about Abraham Lincoln. Might the account of the life of Lincoln freeing the slaves and being a president be a legend too? He said, well, I guess in one sense might, but it's not likely given the preponderance of historical documentation we have regarding Abraham Lincoln. And by the same token, the preponderance of historical documentation we have of Jesus, I think, rules out that possibility. Not only that, myths and legends take time to develop, and this is part of that way of explaining away the gospel account. So that's myth, legend that developed later. But when you look at Paul's writings about Jesus in the mid-50s, for example, within 2 decades after the time of Jesus himself, you see Paul reflecting a high Christology, a Jesus as the Son of God, a Jesus risen from the dead. These are all central pieces of Paul's characterization of Jesus of Nazareth, which shows that these phenomenal characteristics, the miracle-working, rising from the dead, Son of God, Jesus who came to rescue the world, individual, was somebody who was talked about like that right virtually from the very beginning. It's not a later development. And this is another good reason not to accept the notion that our understanding of Jesus from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is some kind of later development. We have really good reasons to believe that high Christology was the earliest proclamation, was part of the earliest proclamation of the gospel. Indeed, the earliest characterization of Jesus was Jesus is Lord.
There you go. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a minute. We are announcing that November 2018, we're going to have not just a youth conference for Rethinks, but we're having a Stand to Reason National Conference.
Right. Actually, 25th anniversary National Conference, because next year is a quarter of a century for Stand to Reason. It seems like it was just yesterday almost we were having our 20th year anniversary, and now we're having our 25th year anniversary.
But the focus of this conference isn't necessarily celebrating Stand to Reason.
That's
it
right.
Just happens to be, okay, we thought this is the time to do something.
This is a good excuse for us doing
something. This is the focus
special
on getting you guys all here and training you.
That's right. The theme is confidence for every Christian, and we understand what it's like to be out there in the world and having the world push back, and we know you're feeling it, and so we're going to do something very special this conference. It's going to be different. I'm just putting a little teaser out there for you. This is going to be a different kind of conference than we've ever had before, and the way we manage it and how we train you, etc. Okay, all we want you to do is set aside the dates, November 2nd and 3rd, 2018. And I'll also add one other thing. We are looking to get somebody representing every single state and every single Canadian province at our conference coming up this fall. So
and if you want to represent another country, you can too.
You can do that as well. So mark the date, November 2nd through 3rd.
Yeah, we're all calling you here. I picture it sort of my favorite Christmas film, White Christmas. There's a scene towards the end where Bing Crosby goes on television and calls the troops from his former unit.
Yep.
And said, we've got a new mission for you. We've got to cheer up our general. Your mission, show up in Vermont,
yeah,
December 24th. that thing. So we're saying we've got a mission for you.
You don't have to cheer me up, though.
No, we've got a mission for you. No, it's not to cheer Greg up. We've got a mission for you. We've got training for you. So we're calling you from all over to show up November 2nd and 3rd of next year. We'll have more details coming. We're just letting you know. It's a save the date kind of thing.
That's right.
That's it for this episode. Send us your questions on Twitter using hashtag STRAsk and mark your calendar for next year, November 2nd and 3rd. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.